Thank you very much, President, both for what you have just said and for letting us have the party here. I am flattered indeed and delighted to see so many people here who have come from afar. And I'm especially happy to see, I think, four former Woodhouse fellows, because they remind me of a particularly happy episode in my time as classics tutor. And it's good, too, to see some of my very oldest pupils in the same room with some of my current ones. The college has always been good to me. It gave me support and confidence when I was young and shy, and now I am old and deaf, it lavishes on me all the material and social privileges of the Emeritus Fellow, including access to what must surely be the finest day centre for elderly gentlemen in Oxford, and perhaps the world, the St John's SCR. When I first got this job in 1948, my tutor at Balliol said to me in a very meaningful voice, "Well, you'll be all right at St John's." The implication was that this was an easy-going sort of place where even I might make the grade. And now I've served under 8 presidents, 6 bursars, and 3 SCR butlers, and I hope I've made the grade. Anyway, I have witnessed an enormous evolution of the college, a great transformation indeed. My old tutor would hardly recognise the present St John's. I've seen the vast expansion of our buildings, largely under the guidance of my contemporary Howard Colvin, who would have shared this anniversary with me. I have seen the surge in academic achievement, which we rightly associate with the presidency of Sir Richard Southern. I've seen the governing body triple in numbers, and a huge new diversity of subjects and research interests. I've seen the college gradually accept, as it hardly did in my early days here, a corporate responsibility for actively promoting research. And last, and perhaps not least, I've seen the advent of women. Just look back to 1948. The Dolphin Building was brand new. Middleton Hall was an outpost on the northern frontier, barely under the control of the deans. The president's stable still stood in the north quad, though it was full not of horses, but of books. And the front quad was all gravel, very dirty and messy in bad weather. The governing body numbered about 20. Now it is over 60. Of the 20, 5 lived in college, strategically stationed amid the subject population. Now I think there is no such fellow living in college. There were very few graduate students, certainly in the humanities. Now they are countless. There was one JRF, John Wayne, who came over from Reading on his motorcycle every Saturday evening to dine with us, more especially to dine with J.B. Leishman, our polymath, and to me very much regretted lecturer in English. Now we count JRFs in dozens. And of course there were no women. What then were fellows up to when I arrived in 1948? Subtract time spent drinking in common room, sitting on committees, visiting estates and playing tennis. They spent the rest of their time on what was and is, and I hope always will be, the core business of the college, namely undergraduate education. In other words, they were giving their pupils sherry. Were they good at this core business? So-so, I would say. Some were, some weren't. And sometimes the sherry was South African. And what was I up to, say, in the first dozen years of my time before my first sabbatical leave in 1960 and the arrival of Martin West as the first Woodhouse Fellow? Let me just give three little snapshots of myself as a youngish fellow. The first shows me standing near President Poole as he cuts the tape and opens the village school, the village shop at Fifield. I wonder if that shop is still there. The second shows me at the Merchant Tailors Hall in Threadneedle Street, taking part in the annual examination of candidates for closed scholarships. That was then a very important part of our admissions procedures. The master of the company is in charge. His job is to protect the boys against our bullying. So when I have finished with one boy and he has been taken away, the master turns to me and says, "Well, I think he stood up to your bowling pretty well." And my third snapshot shows me at 9 o'clock on a foggy Saturday morning going into the Dolphin lecture room to set the weekly collection on 3 books of Homer. I mentioned this last scene lately to Catherine Earnshaw. She seemed interested and even to entertain the idea that this practice might profitably be revived. On this, I offer no opinion. But I have, as it happens, been thinking about the whole business of reintroductions and putting back the clock. Is it ever desirable or practicable? I suspect very rarely. Of course, I would like to put the clock back. At my age, who wouldn't? For example, I would like to go back to a time when more people knew Greek and Latin, especially, if I may say so, students in English literature. Even more, I would like once again to see languages, ancient and modern, more highly valued in education than they seem to be at present. I don't at all like what appears to me to be an impoverishment of mind and of imagination that comes from believing that you can do everything in English and read the books in translation. I am a practicing translator. I love doing it. But I also know the limitations. I know there's really not an awful lot that I can do to give my readers a really close contact with and understanding of the thought processes of an ancient author. To my mind, for a serious student, there's no satisfactory alternative to leaving to learning the language. But I've also been thinking about reintroductions in another context. A few weeks ago, I was sitting in the garden with my cousin and his wife. We were sitting on a seat just under the window of that fine room in the Canterbury Quad that I was lucky enough to occupy half a century ago. I was drinking in, as always, the charm of that wonderful scene. The lawn, its curtains of trees, the backdrop of the copper beech in Wadham Garden. My cousin drew attention to 2 birds circling overhead. They were red kites. Now, these, of course, are a recent reintroduction. They wouldn't be there unless somebody had wanted to put the clock back. They are fine, big, powerful birds. It's a pleasure to watch them circle and swoop. At the same time, they are surely very sinister. They put us in mind of rotting corpses on ancient battlefields or plague-ridden city streets. Our monuments shall be the maws of kites. I wonder what they are waiting for. So I am ambivalent about the kites. About another bird, I'm not ambivalent at all. In the college archives, there is a large file of old Gordy orations going back to the middle years of Queen Victoria. They are not much studied by historians, perhaps because they are in Latin, but they do contain some interesting social history, often concerning fellows and their marriages, and some curious information. In one of them we read that once upon a time there were peacocks in the college garden. Well, should we bring back the peacock? Is there a case for putting back the clock here? My answer is a very definite no. I hope, President, that the college will never contemplate bringing back this ostentatious, self-advertising, noisy, raucous, discordant bird into the calm spaces of the groves. Why am I so sure about this? Because it seems to me that the qualities of the peacock, as just stated, are totally and absolutely at odds with what I have always taken to be core characteristics of St. John's. Of course, we have our self-esteem, actually quite a lot of it, but we don't boast about ourselves too much or flaunt our greatness. There's not all that much display of our tail feathers. And when we want to do something or say something, we tend to do it or say it in a reasonable, moderate, harmonious way, because we have a horror of hideous noises and would do a lot to avoid kicking up a row. So my message is, please, no peacocks. In other words, may the college continue, as it has done in the past, to excel without ostentation and evolve without discord. Please, no peacocks. And thank you once again, President, and thank you all for listening to me.